so glad to be in conversation with the fabulous Serene Shabaya to discuss this most recent border bill negotiated between the Biden administration and the Senate. Serene Shabaya is the executive director of the National Immigration Project. She is an immigrant rights litigator and advocate who focuses on the intersection of immigration, civil rights, racial justice, and criminal justice. Under her leadership, the National Immigration Project combines movement-centered litigation, policy advocacy, narrative change, and training and education strategies to defend and advance the rights of immigrant communities of color. Serene has led successful campaigns to disentangle local law enforcement from immigration enforcement, to expand protective policies at the federal level, and to challenge state and local laws that harm immigrants.
Greetings, friend. Thank you for joining me again.
Hi, Nana. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you, both on and off the air, you know.
Yes. And you know, we're going to do a lot more talking, apparently, because these people, it's been a lot. I'm calling it Biden's bankrupt border bill. You heard it here first. So much in the news about this border bill, particularly in the lead up to it. And then, of course, now, as folks are trying to dissect it and figure out on the political end, you know, the electoral end, how this is going to square up as we move towards these November elections. But I just wanted to step back from the fray a little bit and really look at like how we got into this place in terms of the perceptions that are out there about the border and about the asylum system. Because I feel like, you know, as we've gone sort of into Title 42 and then come out of Title 42, and more folks have come into the country because, you know, Title 42 had ended. You had Abbott's buses and DeSantis flying people. And there's just been such, you know, so many narratives around the border that have emerged. And I think, you know, so much misconception that has emerged that it would be important to deal with. So let's deal with the first most basic one, which is this idea that the border is open. You know, you have this notion of like a marauding crew. I think of like the Birth of a Nation, you know, imagery of just like these people coming through and invading the southern border towns of the United States and coming up into Chicago, New York, D.C., etc. Let's address that first. This border is open notion, like there's no process. People are just jumping walls, etc. How real is that?
It could not be further from the truth, Nana. And it has been such a repeated misconception over many, many years that somehow the border is too open, too porous. But the reality is that what we saw actually was that policies that closed down the border, like Title 42, actually ended up leading to more people trying to cross many different times and chaotic situations at the border, which is still an ongoing situation since the Trump administration and since all of these policies have been in place that have caused you know, backlogs and problems at the border, and also created essentially a humanitarian crisis where people are, you know, stuck in different parts of Mexico, exposed to really dangerous conditions, and where it becomes this mythical idea that somehow the border is open and people just come and go as they please. And that has never been the case. And in fact, the situation gets worse when the border, when like stricter restrictions are in place, such as Title 42. And we definitely saw that when Title 42 was in place, there were more people who were trying to cross and not able to cross in any way, people in desperate circumstances, and basically like repeat attempts to come to the border and then have to go back and then come to the border and have to go back. And that actually significantly contributed to the chaos that people talk about at the border. The reality is that there are already a lot of restrictions on people coming into the United States, and that the more that these restrictions are amplified, the more chaos that produces. And when people are able to come in an orderly way, and there are actually a lot of studies out there that show that having a more welcoming system, or a system that actually helps people figure out what their situation is and get to where they're trying to go, would end up leading to far less chaos. And the issues that are happening at the border right now are very much sort of purposefully produced. Like there is a perception, I think, among certain politicians that playing games with people's lives is a good idea because it increases their chances of getting elected. There is a fear-mongering narrative about what the situation really is, and you know, the nature of, you know, immigration, migration, and movement of people across borders in this country. All of the studies that have been done that are rigorous studies have shown that immigrants coming in and contributing to the economy and contributing to our communities is a net benefit for the American, you know, community, for our society, for the way that we kind of have lived and grown and flourished in different parts of the country. But the fear-mongering narrative is out there and has taken hold, and it's actually what's driving a lot of these policies across the border that are just making the situation worse in many different places.
I mean, I'm thinking about how, you know, just the metering system. Like, this was during the President Obama's time, where they're like handing people a ticket darn near like you were standing at a meat market, right? In the meat part of the market, and you're number 69, someone else is number 125. And then they would only let so many people over at a time. Like, that did not deter people. Like, I think part of the idea is that the thought is that, hey, if we make it difficult, if we make it arduous, if we make it cruel, if we make it so that, you know, the word gets around on the migrant, you know, hotline, the migrant rumor hotline, that this is just such a hard process that people are not going to come. But I mean, even under Title 42, where people was made clear that the border is literally shut down, except in, you know, limited situations, including, you know, if you're Ukrainian, even in those situations, people still came. Like, it didn't stop people from coming. Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, other folks in the administration telling people, don't come, we'll put money into your countries, we'll try to develop your countries. It didn't stop people from coming. Like, people are going to move. Your comments.
Absolutely. And I also think that when you talk about this in kind of an abstract way, you kind of lose the reality of what it actually takes for someone to make the journey to the border and to walk between all of these thousands and thousands of miles where you don't have ports of entry across most of it. And also, like, what it takes to even get to that place where you're coming here to seek asylum or to flee a terrible situation. And the reality is that that is a very harrowing journey. And you wouldn't take it lightly, and you wouldn't do it if you had other options. And the idea that somehow shutting down the border is going to solve the problem is something that has been truly disproven over and over again, because even when the border was shut down, what ended up happening is essentially encampments in Mexico, or people kind of waiting and going, coming and being exposed to very dangerous circumstances, in some cases dying, because they were not being allowed to come in an orderly way. I think beyond the fact that the asylum system itself is actually pretty narrow. So, like, even if you're coming here to seek asylum, the circumstances where you could get asylum are not actually that generous or that broad. There are many, many reasons for people to move, and there are many actually demands. You know, there's like climate change, there's economic reasons. There are a number of different drivers for why people move, and it really has not made things any better to try to close the border down. And instead, what we should be focusing on, and what would actually, it's almost like there has been kind of an intentional refusal to address the situation in a way that makes any sense, just in order to continue to keep a border quote unquote crisis going, so that people can campaign off of it and essentially use people as political pawns instead of addressing the realities of the situation. There's been, like, I mean, advocates and you know, researchers and et cetera, for decades have been saying there are humane, decent ways to have sort of systems of processing at the border to allow people to come and go, there are a lot of different ways that you could structure this so that it's not creating that, you know, that crush or that kind of desperation to be able to find a place to come in. But none of the times when the border is shut down have been times that have actually led to anything better than the alternative. And as you were saying, Nana, like if someone has a reason to come, they're going to come. It doesn't really matter what policies are in place. And it's not the policies in place that are driving whether people come or not. It's what's going on in their situation and their home country and, you know, the various wars and disasters and different things that are going on. And it's really important to note that the obligation to provide refuge and to provide asylum is actually an international commitment that the United States has. And so this new bill and these kind of previous attempts to shut down the border have really all been in violation of the U.S.'s obligations under the Refugee Convention. And a lot of the policies that are being contemplated now, as well as the policies that were put in place under the Trump administration, like metering or Remain in Mexico or Title 42, have really been in direct violation of that obligation to provide refuge to people who are coming here seeking asylum. And, you know, beyond the question about seeking asylum, it truly has been borne out like time and time again by research that has been done on this, that having immigrants being able to come in and having a freer flow of movement is actually beneficial to the economy. And so, you know, the talking points that are opposed to that are just attempts to create like an us versus them dynamic, attempts to play on racial tropes and to sort of stoke fear of people who are not coming from white European countries and somehow make it seem as though there is a difference fundamentally. And you see actually, even among the people who are ostensibly being really restrictive about immigration, that if it's about immigration from Northern Europe, or if it's about the Ukraine, or if it's about a country that's traditionally white, they don't have the objections that they have when it's from, you know, South and Central American countries, when it's from Africa. Like those are the places where we see people being afraid of immigration and fear mongering about immigration. And it really is rooted in a fundamentally racist and white supremacist ideology that is kind of using the fact that the border has been closed and the fact that the situation has been very difficult for people who are trying to come here and that there's kind of a backlog and deficiencies that are pretty much due to the fact that our system is not open in the way that it should be, as a way to stoke people's fears and to create more openings for politicians to put forward hateful proposals and harmful proposals like the one that came out yesterday.
And I definitely thank you for all of that, Serene. I definitely want to talk a little bit more about the racial aspect of this, because when I was looking through what it's like over 300 pages, so I'm looking flipping through that, really trying to focus on the summaries that folks are sending and the comments and the statements that are being made by folks like you and National Immigration Project, and really trying to absorb and see, okay, you know, what's the impact to Black migrants? And the, you know, I can't help because I'm old as dirt and twice as funky, but think about the 94 crime bill and like what led to that, which we now know. In terms of the 94 crime bill and the 96 IRA, we, you know, now folks are apologizing. Now folks are like, oh, we didn't know, or we were so desperate, or we were this, we were that, and we ruined millions of people's lives. And, you know, you actually don't know how to fix it now and all of these things. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, this smells like that. Like something that is rooted in all of these racist tropes and these ideas about who belongs, who deserves empathy, who deserves, you know, a chance, who deserves opportunity and who does not deserve opportunity, falling along those race and class and gender, all those lines, right, that things fall on in this country, and thinking about if this passes, who are going to be the people that are going to be telling us 5-10 years from now about how they didn't know, they didn't know, they didn't know. And, you know, they're full of regret as people's, you know, have lost their lives and suffered other atrocities as a result of this bill becoming law. But before I get into that, wanting to talk about, and before we get into the bill itself, wanting to talk about this idea also that people don't get punished if, in fact, they are, you know, if they come across the border without going through a process, right? When we know, like in other countries, it's not a crime for you to cross the border without a process. But in the United States, it absolutely is something that we are pushing back against, following the lead of orgs like National Immigration Project. Talk to us about that, because I think people really don't know that people are getting prosecuted for crossing the border on, you know, in not just in Texas, but on this federal level.
Absolutely. So for decades, and this was actually the result of an explicitly white supremacist, racist law that wanted to stop specifically Mexicans at the time, but also generally, you know, people from South America and Central America from coming to the United States. And a bill was passed that essentially made it possible for the federal government to prosecute people for entering not at a port of entry. And so that's, you know, illegal entry or illegal reentry are the two provisions that have been used to prosecute immigrants. And they have been used very heavily by administrations, especially since the Bush administration. So like for a while during the pandemic, those prosecutions declined. But more recently, they have been increasing again. And that is something that the government has never stopped doing. It has never stopped prosecuting people for illegal entry or reentry. Both of these are incredibly racist laws, and they are punitive and lead to more incarceration and don't actually, again, deter immigration, because oftentimes people don't even, you know that they're being prosecuted criminally versus being, you know, brought to the immigration system. And just everything about it is really racist and confusing. And what ends up happening in Texas is that on top of all of those federal kind of prosecution measures, you now have state laws that are going after people that are arguably, you know, illegal and unconstitutional, also completely inhumane and violate people's human rights. But on top of the local laws that Texas has passed, where they're going after people and prosecuting them essentially for, you know, for their race, and for, you know, being in Texas, which is not something that a state should be able to do. The federal government also goes after people and prosecutes them for entering unlawfully or without the proper authorization. And that is something that has happened for decades and that has continued to happen. And it's just another example of how punitive the immigration system is across all levels. So you have these criminal prosecutions. Then when you actually get into the immigration system, if you're lucky, you get to go in front of a court. But even there, your options for making a case to stay are very small. You know, when people talk about like, why do people come without authorization and they should come legally, there really are almost no avenues for people to come lawfully to the United States. And that's just a reality that people, I think, don't understand. Like, the immigration system was designed to be incredibly restrictive and incredibly punitive. And that has been the case, even though the United States has always flourished and relied on immigrants, on immigrant labor, on immigrant contributions, on, you know, the kind of social and community aspects of building families and communities. And that's just something that the immigration system has not really acknowledged, and instead has been, you know, iteration after iteration has been based on trying to shut people out, and especially brown people, black people, people of color, people from places that are not, you know, Northern Europe.
Thank you for that, because I think people, you know, that's one that I keep having to explain to people, like, you don't know the percentage of people that are in federal prison right now just for that illegal entry and reentry. And if you did, you would not keep talking about how no one's getting punished for it. Looking at the bill that we have now, we understand people are still going to fight and wrangle, etc. We don't know exactly what it's going to look like, really. And even, you know, whether it's going to get past the Senate, let alone the House, where House Republicans are saying it's dead on arrival. So we're not quite clear what's happening with it. But right now, the threat is there and it's real. What would you say are like that some of the top line things that you're concerned about and that we all should be concerned about in this bill?
there is so much to be concerned about in this bill, including the messaging of the bill, but just kind of going more into the details of what it would actually do. It's an alarming bill that basically uses like a spending bill. So like a bill that's about funding the government and uses that vehicle in order to decimate the U.S. asylum system and to increase detention and family detention and essentially exacerbate or increase the challenges that we've been seeing on the border by shutting down the border and by creating these very complex procedures that undermine rights under U.S. law and under international law. So just as top lines, essentially there are like trigger numbers where the U.S. government would be able to steal the border to people seeking asylum. So even if you're coming fleeing harm or you would actually lawfully be eligible for asylum, the border would just be closed. It essentially adds different legal standards than the ones that are already existing. So currently you have to show a certain level of sort of like success in your claim in order to be allowed to even come here and seek asylum. And the bill would increase that standard significantly in a way that really harms particularly Indigenous people, LGBTQ people, people who have complex asylum claims like survivors of gender-based violence who don't have the time or support to be able to understand how to articulate the legal basis of their claims. It also essentially creates like a new process that is incredibly fast-tracked for asylum processing without any judicial review and putting people under surveillance for the entire time. And it entrenches detention, prosecution, creating a border wall, like all of these things that have time and time again been shown to be incredibly harmful. It essentially increases detention. It actually creates like a new family detention system, really under another name. There'd be like a staging facility for deportations of families that would essentially function like the family detention situation that we saw kind of play out in this horrible way under Bush, Obama, and prior administrations. It would also increase prosecutions of people just for the act of crossing the border, which is, again, we've sort of talked about that before, but it is an incredibly harmful and racist practice that causes people to end up being incarcerated for really long periods of time. It separates them from their families. That was actually the practice that caused the family separation crisis of 2018, and that continues to separate families now. It undermines due process. It undermines the ability of people to seek asylum, because if they're being prosecuted and incarcerated, they don't really have access to legal representation or orientation or any of the things that might help them understand what their rights might be to actually seek safety in the United States or get immigration status in the United States. And then it funds border wall construction in a way that, as you know, I think there's been a lot of materials out there that show how it's going to result in bulldozing Native American burial sites, and it's going to create really terrible environmental impacts. And it exacerbates the dangerousness of the terrain where people are crossing. So it's going to cause injury and death to thousands of people. So really at a very high level, the bill violates the Refugee Convention because it closes the border to people who are seeking safety. It completely exacerbates the current humanitarian and operational challenges at the border. It makes asylum largely inaccessible for people who lawfully should be able to ask for it at ports of entry. And then it punishes people who come by incarcerating them, prosecuting them, and essentially just results in a lot of money in the pockets of private prison companies who have a lot of incentives to really want to promote the system where people are just detained, where the border is shut down, where everything about the immigration system is incredibly punitive and the opposite of like a reasonable, compassionate, humanitarian processing system that enables people to understand their options, get to where they're trying to go, and go through the system in an orderly way.
No other problems.
That's it. That's all of it. I mean, actually, there are a lot more terrible. Sorry. Yeah, there are a lot more terrible details, but this is just the top line.
Absolutely. And, you know, we giggle, but literally I was telling one of my relatives, if this was a video game, like, and these are the kinds of things, you know, that at Baji we sit down and try to think about, like, who can we get to create a game? If there was a video game or even a movie in which you had people, the protagonist was, you know, a person who was trying to make it, you know, was escaping danger, or was escaping climate crisis, or was escaping, you know, extreme impoverishment, right? That was the result of structures outside of themselves. And they were making this desperate journey to go into a country that promised that if you made it here, that you would be welcomed. And we try, you know, either through the game or if it's a movie, whatever works in your brain, you know, you see the trials and tribulations the person has to go through, crossing rivers, walking these landmass, you know, surviving robberies, surviving rapes in some cases, seeing people fall into rivers and dying, like all of these moments, right? And moments of triumph where people make it, where people actually find some little place that they can huddle with other folks and not be in the elements, you know? And imagine, you know, how we, as we're watching this, what we would be feeling and how we'd be rooting for these people to be able to make it through to this place, right? This magical place where they're going to be able to live their lives freely. And then when they came to the border of that place, if then they found out, or we all find out in this game or in this movie, that actually, no, it's not what you thought. And there's all of these requirements that you have to have. And you're treated as if you are coming to do something bad, like you have a nefarious purpose for coming in. You're instantly criminalized because you're a person in need. You're forced to be in a space which, for example, for a lot of Black folks is actually anti-Black, and where people are experiencing discrimination, violence, literally people being killed dead based upon their race, right? And you would be thinking, oh my gosh, this is like the evil empire. I'm so disappointed. These people, I feel so badly for these people. They went through all of this to get to this place. And now that they've gotten here, they're being looked down upon. They're being treated as if they're some kind of vermin. They're being put through all of these paces. Their families are being separated. You know, they're being torn apart from their children or from their loved ones, from their partners. Like, no one would be looking at the country doing that and saying, good for you. What a wonderful job. And we would be feeling for the protagonist. And if there were some in that group that said, hey, I'm just going to run over, I'm going to try to get across the wall, we would be saying, yes, 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 yes. And those who made it, we cheer for them. And those who fell and hurt themselves and didn't make it, we would be crying tears for them in that cinema. And that's movie. That's not real life, people. That's not real life. But that's the real life that it's already happening to people and is going to be made even worse by this bill. How do people push back? How do people get more information on what they can do to make sure that this bill, that people hear from them about the ways in which this bill is harmful and that, you know, should not be turned into law?
Absolutely. I mean, you really described it so perfectly. And it's such a tragic situation right now that the airwaves have been so flooded with these negative narratives that people aren't even distinguishing, you know, between how similar this is to situations where we would be rooting for people to actually be able to get to safety. And that's really something that I think we should all hold on to. So in terms of opposing the bill, I think what's really, really important right now is for people to call their senators and register their opposition. There are a number of resources out there. The ACLU has a click to oppose like campaign where you can essentially just click on something and it pre-populates information for you so that you can communicate with your legislators. Because the bill is being considered in the Senate, it's very, very important to make voices heard and to let your senators know that it is not okay to pass these hateful bills and to essentially eviscerate what little is left of the immigration and asylum systems. And, you know, I think for organizations, there is a lot of advocacy going on right now. There are people who are trying to provide some education on the bill. There's, you know, a lot of work that's happening to really produce materials that summarize the bill and that alert people to all of the harmful parts of it, which are sort of, which can be hidden or less obvious. But I think if you're a listener and you're there and you think that this is another kind of egregious example of, you know, policies that we all thought would be gone after the Trump administration, but seem to be continuing now, then the most important thing to do right now is to make your voices heard and to reach out to your senators, to your representatives, and just let them know that you don't stand for this and you do not want them to vote for this horrible, harmful bill.
Thank you again so much, Serene. I so appreciate you. Folks, if you're looking for information about how this bill will directly impact Black folks, I'm, of course, going to encourage you to go to Baji's website at baji.org and to follow Baji on Twitter, Instagram. We'll be doing an Instagram live and other things just to zero in on how this impacts Black migrants. I obviously also want folks to be connected with you, Serene, and with National Immigration Project. How do folks connect with National Immigration Project, follow, et cetera, to keep abreast of this ever-moving train here that is the attacks on immigration and particularly as it pertains to the border?
Yeah, so our website is nipnlg.org. You can reach us there. You can also follow us on X, I guess it's called now. And you can find us on social media. And those are probably the best ways to kind of stay in touch. And, you know, we also put out content regularly about these various things, like explainers about latest developments, as well as other materials that might be of interest. So definitely feel free to follow us on social media, you know, visit our website, and that's a great way to stay in touch.
Thank you so much, Serene. I so appreciate you.
Thank you, Nana. You're amazing. I'm so glad that you're doing this. And it's always wonderful to talk to you, even about these terrible subjects.
Even about these terrible subjects. Thank you.
That was Serene Shabaya, Executive Director of the National Immigration Project, on the recent border bill and the attack on asylum. Reminder that we need you. We need you now. We need you always. 818-985-5735. You are the engine that keeps this station going. You are the reason that we're here. You know, it may sound like it sometimes, but we're actually not here just to talk to ourselves and hear ourselves talk. We're here to connect with you. And KPFK has been doing that decade after decade. And we intend to keep doing it until liberation comes. But we need your help. 818-985-5735. We thank you so much for those who have already donated. We thank you to those who have donated again and again, to those who specifically say, hey, I'm donating in the name of Conversations on the Way. We thank you. We appreciate that, the love. And we want you to know that the love is reciprocated. Until there is at minimum a permanent ceasefire, we will continue to talk about the genocide in Gaza and the U.S. and the West's complicity in it. We continue our calls for the end of occupation and genocide in Palestine. And we take this moment to also lift up the war in Sudan that has been going on for nearly 10 months now, with no end clearly in sight. Over 9 million people have been displaced, and 13 to 15,000 people have been killed as of January 21st of this year. We turn to a conversation we had 2 months ago with Dr. Nasreen El Amin, professor at the University of Toronto, about the war in Sudan and the most sustainable source for peace. That was an excerpt of a longer conversation I had, a rebroadcast of that conversation with Dr. Nasreen El Amin, professor at the University of Toronto, on the war in Sudan. Conversations on the Way. I'm your host, Nana Jumphy, and I'm looking forward to sharing conversations at the various intersections of liberation for the people and the planet with you. Thank you for being here with us. Today's conversation is at the intersection of human rights and human dignity. As the genocide and ethnocide rage on against Palestinians in Gaza, we turn to consider the conditions in other countries in the global south, where war and ethnocide threaten millions of lives. Pleased to be in conversation with Dr. Nasreen El Amin about the continuing conflict, crisis, and community care in the Sudan. Dr. El Amin is an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and African Studies program at the University of Toronto. She's not only an expert on Sudan, but also from Sudan, and made the harrowing journey with her toddler and has family members still living there today. Greetings, sis. So glad to have you on the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me and for covering what's happening in Sudan at the moment. It's so important.
Thank you. Yes, it is important. We are all concerned about what is happening in Palestine, of course. It also brings to the surface the conversation about the type of suffering that people are going through as a result of settler colonialism, imperialism, capitalism, all of the isms. And we certainly want to make sure that folks remember that there are other parts of the world that have been and continue to be impacted and having that same kind of human suffering and conflict as well. I want to be able to get into the politics of the war in Sudan, but I think we need to first be clearer about the human aspects of the conflict, because I think it's so easy for us to jump into the pieces of, you know, who's who and what's what and what are they doing, and sort of skip over what are the impacts that people are having on their daily life. And you, as someone who is Sudanese, who was in Sudan for a part of this time period, who has relatives who are in Sudan, I think it's important for us to hear from you what is happening with our folks there.
Yes, thank you for that question. So what's happening currently on the ground in Sudan, particularly in the most, in the sort of war impacted parts of the country, Khartoum, the state of Darfur, Kordofan, and other places, is that we're really looking at what officials in the UN have called the kind of worst humanitarian disaster in the world at the moment, right? So there are about 45 million Sudanese who are all caught in the senseless war, and 25 million of them are in urgent need of humanitarian assistance and food aid in a country that could feed itself. About 7 million people have been internally displaced, and that number comes from the UN. Again, it's hard to gather data at the moment because these international bodies that usually gather data are not on the ground. People in Sudan estimate that it's more like 10 million people, and that makes Sudan the largest internal displacement crisis in the world. 19 million children are out of school. The healthcare system has collapsed. The civilian state has been absent for a very long time. And so that's really, you know, an over the death toll. It's a very difficult to kind of put an official figure out there. The official figure is about 10,000 right now. But really, what we've seen in the last couple of weeks in particular is there have been massacres in West Darfur targeting particular ethnic groups that have been in the 10, you know, in around 10,000. And so I think the estimates are here again about 30,000 plus. So it's really difficult to say how many people have been killed in this war. But the situation is made particularly dire by the fact that the international aid community has for the most part been absent. Or, you know, as only a few organizations are really on the ground. In fact, most of the humanitarian relief effort is carried by Sudanese volunteers. There's something called emergency response rooms, which are these volunteer-run, kind of flexible response rooms that have emerged across the country. There are 69 of them in Khartoum alone, coordinated by over 1,400 volunteers. And they are the ones doing the work of food and medicine distribution. They're driving ambulances, setting up emergency clinics, rape crisis centers. They are, you know, organizing communal kitchens and learning for children. They're turning schools into shelters for displaced people, et cetera. And this is, you know, all being done in a sort of, this kind of structure emerged from the neighborhood resistance committees, which are these committees that are the backbone of the Sudanese revolution. There are about 8,000 of them across the country that are consensus-based, volunteer-run, rely on mutual aid and kind of support from the diaspora, but also people inside the country. But there's also really only so much they can do, right, given the circumstances. So that's basically the situation on the ground at the moment. It's really dire. Only 26% of the aid that the UN estimates is required, which is $3 billion to fill the needs of people on the ground, has actually been pledged by the international community. And that's why Sudan sort of falling off the radar is particularly dangerous at this time. And I'll say my own family members, I have a cousin who's currently renting an apartment for $300 in a rural area. He's got four kids that are under the age of 10, and they're all not eating enough and not eating well, and they keep getting sick, they keep getting malaria and other kinds of diseases. And because the healthcare system has collapsed, you know, these are the kinds of things that keep us up at night, because it's not, you know, we're just not sure like how long people are really going to be able to sustain this.
Thank you so very much for that, because I think sometimes also when we talk about the numbers, even that, though they are shocking, it becomes too much for our brains to wrap around, right? So it's like 7 million people internally displaced. And it's, you know, it's hard for people to wrap their brain around that. You know, I say to folks, if you look at Los Angeles County, there's between 60 to 100,000, you know, depending on who you ask, unhoused people that are there. And this is the, you know, five to low six figure, right? And it seems to people like, oh my goodness, you know, what is going on? So imagine 7 million internally displaced people. Right. And what that actually looks like and what that means. Again, when we look at the over a million Palestinians who have been displaced, internally displaced within Palestine, you know, we understand that's a lot of people. You can't wrap your brain around it, but you can still, you see the images. It's a lot of people. We're talking 7 million people just in the conversation about the internally displaced. We're talking, you know, three times as many people, potentially maybe more, as what we are understanding. Again, all of these numbers are semi-unofficial, right? Folks that have been killed in Palestine. Doing the comparison, not for the oppression Olympics, but to give people a sense of magnitude, right? Like sometimes you stand next to the baobab so that people can understand the difference between the height baobab looks like. And conversation where we're talking about leaving the houses, fleeing, and then other folks are coming in and just taking everything in the house. So much that is happening. So thank you for sharing all of that. How did we get here? You know, I think there's a notion in people's mind that when you're talking about Africa, that isn't this your life? Aren't you always fighting and killing each other and, you know, hungry and displaced and needing medication, etc.? And when people say Sudan in particular, right, there are certain countries, Sudan, Somalia, right, that ding, ding, ding in people's head and they figure utter chaos all the time. So give us a little hint about what Sudan, you know, who Sudan is, what Sudan is in terms of the people, you know, as you said, could feed itself, et cetera. And then how did we get to this place?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. And I also want to just sort of add to the last answer that you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the things that has been so heartbreaking about the situation is that many people among those 7 million have been displaced multiple times, right? They've, even for ourselves, when before we evacuated, we left where we first were, you know, the place that my mother grew up in Khartoum, to go somewhere else that we thought was safer. That became unsafe because, you know, the militias started invading people's homes and kicking them out. And there's a lot of gender-based sexual violence as well. And then, you know, we evacuated to a rural area that has now also become unsafe because of these raids and attacks. So, you know, people are kind of dealing with multiple layers of trauma here as well. And so in terms of how we got here, you know, I look at this war as the kind of counter-revolution. There was a revolution that started in December of 2018 that in April ousted the 30-year dictatorship of Omar Hassan al-Bashir, converged in a kind of massive 1 million person sit-in in front of the military headquarters in Khartoum, demanding not only regime change,